he said, his voice rough with the words he was holding back.
I know things are bad right now, so it makes sense that you need space. I can give you space.
This isn't about Ty, I said. I'd be doing this even if Ty hadn't died. Hurt in his brown eyes, then, a universe of hurt.
Oh,
was all he said. It was a good experiment, but I couldn't look at him. Out the window, snow was falling in fat flakes, the kind of snowstorm that makes everything seem muted. I've concluded that you and I aren't compatible. In the long run, I mean. I think you're a stellar guy, I do, but it was never going to work between us. I sounded like a Vulcan. It was the lamest breakup speech ever in the history of mankind. All around us, there was music and laughing, his little sister and cousin shrieking in a game of tag, drinks clinking and resolutions being made, a cacophony of noise. But all I could hear was the way Stephen caught his breath.
This is bad timing. I'm sorry. I should go,
I said, and fled for the front door. He found my jacket in the heap of coats on the guest room bed and held it out for me as I slipped my arms into the sleeves. Then he followed me outside to where the Lemon was parked down the street and helped me scrape the snow off my windshield. He said nothing the entire time. He didn't rage or argue or try to assign blame. But when at last I met his eyes over the roof of my car, he held my gaze. There was snow in his hair and his cheeks were red, the streetlight reflecting in his glasses.
Why?
He asked. Why?
Why wouldn't it work between us?
I didn't know the answer. I couldn't tell him about the text, so I floundered for some reasonable lie. Do you know that there are different types of sperm?
He stared at me. You're breaking up with me because of my sperm? But you don't... we haven't... you have no basis for...
No, not your sperm specifically, just... there are different types of sperm. I read about it. There are some sperm that are meant to swim as quickly as possible up the... well, you get the idea. They're meant to sprint for the finish line, so to speak. But there are also sperm that are supposed to curl up along the way and die. Do you know why they would do that?
I have a feeling you're going to tell me.
So they can block other sperm. They're like defensive lineman sperm, kamikaze sperm.
Fascinating,
Stephen said wryly. So you know what that means? He thought for a minute before I saw the answer flare in his eyes.
It means that we're biologically engineered to be non-monogamous. Females aren't designed to have one single mate, not if our sperm is meant to compete.
Exactly. He ran a hand through his hair, dusting off snow.
That doesn't have anything to do with us, Lex. This isn't biology.
Then I told him the biggest lie of all. I didn't mean it. What I said that night, I got caught up for a minute, but I don't believe in love. I believe in biology. His eyes dropped from mine immediately. He started backing away toward the warm, welcoming light of his house and his family and his future.
Drive safe, Lex,
he murmured. That was the last thing he said to me as my boyfriend. Drive safe. 27. This week with Dad, it's the Outback. He's late. I sit at a table drinking strawberry lemonade for 20 minutes before I take out my phone, but I don't call him. I stare at the screen and think about calling him. I resent him for making me think about calling him. Finally, he shows up, jogging toward me in the darkened restaurant.
Sorry,
he says as he slides into the booth across from me.
Megan wanted...
He stops himself. He remembers I don't want to hear about Megan. I suck down more lemonade as he takes off his coat and gloves and picks up the menu.
How was your week?
He asks. Fantastic, I deadpan.
I know things must have been difficult. What with the Murphy boy? It's such a shame.
I stare at him. Yes, a shame.
You got into MIT, I hear, he says. You're making plans.
He doesn't look thrilled. Why doesn't he look thrilled? How do you know that?
Your mother called me.
A swallow of lemonade goes down the wrong pipe and I cough.
Mom calls you?
From time to time. She's worried about you, and she wants to discuss what to do with you.
I continue coughing.
What to do with me?
How to help you.
He corrects himself, because obviously he phrased that badly.
I'm not the one who needs help.
This comes out without me meaning it to. Dad looks away like he's embarrassed that I would be this rudely straightforward, like he doesn't know me at all. The waitress comes for our order. Dad orders a huge steak and a wallaby darned some kind of peach drink. I order a salad. Then we sit in awkward silence for a while, sawing off pieces of the dark rye bread that was served to us, chewing our thoughts.
That's tremendous news about MIT, Dad says finally.
Yes, tremendous.
Do you have any idea how much...
He trails off, and that's when I understand what his hang-up is. He wants to know how much it costs. Of course he does. He has no money to send me to MIT.
How much will it cost?
Here. I fish the fat envelope out of my bag and hand it to him. He rifles through the pages until he lands on the financial outlook sheet.
So, you have a scholarship?
A bunch of scholarships, yes, which should cover tuition, but then I have to pay for housing, food, books, fees, and other stuff, which I estimate will cost another $15,000 a year. I can get a part-time job when I'm there. They have tutorships and stuff set up. And I have some savings.
You have savings?
He asks, like the idea of me with money defies all logic. I have a little under 20,000, I admit. His eyes widen.
$20,000?
No, 20,000 beaver pelts. Of course $20,000.
How did you manage that?
I saved every penny I made from my summer jobs for the past 3 years. You remember when I worked at the Jimmy John's downtown? That was $8 an hour, and a lot of sandwiches, so it was two birds, one stone that summer. I babysat for the Bueller triplets a bunch this year. I got birthday money from Grandma. It adds up. Specifically, it adds up to like $19,776.42. So I can afford this. Without taking loans, I hope. I watch the tension leak out of him.
Lexi, this is tremendous news, he says, and he means it this time.
He breaks into a wide smile.
Congratulations, Peanut.
Peanut. All it takes for me to become his little girl again is to pay my own way into a top-notch university.
I'm so proud of you, honey.
He points at the letter.
Did you read what it says here? You're one of the most talented and promising students they've had in the most competitive applicant pool they've had in years. You're one in a million.
I'm one in 11, I clarify. There were 18,109 applicants and 1,620 students admitted, so that's one in 11.
Still,
he refuses to let me take the wind out of his sails.
That's impressive. That's amazing. That's...
Can you stop? I say. He looks baffled.
Stop what?
Stop celebrating.
Why? This is it, Lex. What we've dreamed about for you all this time. The life we've wanted for you.
I can't hold it in. Is it? This is the life you've always wanted for me? I gesture around us, at all the happy people eating their happy steaks, celebrating anniversaries or birthdays or paychecks. This? The waitress shows up with my salad and looks uncomfortable, because we're obviously having an argument. Hey, don't worry about it, I tell her. Take it back. I'm not hungry anymore. She sets the salad on the table anyway, then speed walks away. I grab the MIT materials and return them to the envelope, then stuff it into my bag and start to gather up my coat.
Peanut,
Dad says. Don't call me that, I bark. I am not your peanut. You don't get to call me that anymore. His expression hardens.
What is wrong with you? You're acting like a child.
I am your child, technically speaking, I retort. Or did you forget? He rears back like I slapped him.
Why are you so angry?
Oh, let me count the ways. Because this is not what I wanted my life to be. This is not the situation I pictured in my head when I told my dad I was going to MIT. We should be gathered around the kitchen table, Mom, Dad, Ty, and me. I would pass the letter around to them, and everyone would be smiling, and Ty would tease me about being an egghead, and I would fake punch him, and we would laugh and celebrate my escape from Nebraska, but it wouldn't feel like an escape from anything bad. I shouldn't be telling Mom in order to get her through a crying jag, and Dad at some crappy chain restaurant, and Ty in the cold ground. But that's my life. And can I say any of this to him? Can I say, you screwed up everything, it's all your fault, the way I said it so easily to Steven last month? Can I tell him what I really think, call him a cheater, a liar? All the pieces of broken glass that night in the park with Ty after Dad left us? Of course I can't. If I told him those things, I would lose him more than I already have. I would lose him for good. I can't lose anyone else. But I can't tell him about the photo either. About Ty wanting that space in the collage for him. I can't. He doesn't deserve that. I have to go, I say to Dad, my voice catching. Enjoy your steak. He stares after me as I storm out. I sit in the car for a few minutes, fogging up the windshield with my ragged breaths, trying to get myself together enough to drive. Please, Lemon, I plead, stroking the steering wheel. You can do this. I turn the key. She starts up with an unhealthy little sputter, but she starts. Thank you, I breathe, and then I put her in gear, and I refuse to look at Dad's face in the window as I make my getaway. Sadie McIntyre is waiting on the front porch when I get back to the house, sitting on the steps smoking a cigarette. I don't know why I'm surprised. Don't you park in the garage? She asks as I come up to the sidewalk, then figures it out and answers her own question. Oh, right. Of course you don't. Did you want something? I'm ready to take Mom's approach and go to bed early so that this tremendous day will be over. Stick a fork in me. I'm done. I wanted to check up on you, she says. I haven't, talked to you for a while. Not since. Patrick, I fill in. I lumber down onto the steps beside her. I didn't see you at the funeral. I had to work, she says with a sideways glance. Yep, guilt. But those things are hard for me. It takes me back to when... Me too. We sit for a minute. Her smoking, me trying not to breathe it in. You know what I remember most from my dad's? She says after a while. People kept saying, it's going to be all right. That's what they told me over and over and over, don't you worry, little girl, it will all be okay. Because there's got to be some bullshit overall rule of the universe that no matter what happens, no matter how bad it gets, everything will be all right in the end. Yeah, I murmur. And you know what I kept thinking? I kept thinking, that is a fucking lie. It is not going to be all right. It will never be all right, ever, ever again, so stop fucking lying to me. You thought that? How old were you, 15, that you thought stop fucking lying? Her blue eyes crinkle up in amusement. I had an advanced vocabulary for my age. So I gather. She laughs and smokes. I'm sorry I wasn't there for you, I say after a minute. You came to Ty's funeral, but I didn't go to your dad's. She shrugs. I wasn't there for you when your dad checked out either. Plus, I wouldn't have been able to appreciate you being there at the time anyway. And knowing me, I probably would have said something stupid like, it's going to be all right. We both smirk. Well... You don't know until you know, she says. Then she's ready to change the subject. So how's it going with the spirit situation? Have you seen him again? She asks. Since you gave the letter to Ashley, I want details. I can't help but tense up. I've seen him. A lot? Yes, a lot. Halfway through the state of Missouri in the backseat of the car, a lot. Anyway, there's something else now. Something else?
Sadie tries to sound like it's no big deal, but I can tell she's interested. She's able to see this Thai ghost thing as a simple mystery to be solved, because it's not her house, not her life. You remember the collage Thai made for his own funeral? He put all of these pictures in a special frame. She looks appropriately somber. Yes. And there was a blank space in the collage. She nods. I sigh. That space was supposed to be for a picture of my dad, and I found the picture, and I feel like Ty wants... he would want me to give it to my dad. Oh, okay, that sounds complicated. You're telling me. I lean my head back and wish there were stars to gaze up at, but the sky is muted by clouds, a dark, oppressive gray. It's March, but I can smell snow in the air. It feels like this winter is hanging on, that it's never going to end. I sigh. I do not want to deal with my dad. I get that. Your dad's a douche, Sadie says. I sit up. What'd you say? Your mom, she is so great. Sadie puts her chin in her hand, her eyes lost in thought. I always wished my mom could be more like your mom. My mom is so uptight about everything. Your mom was so laid back and funny. She used to make pancakes shaped like teddy bears with the chocolate chip eyes and the strawberry mouth. And she sewed you all these great costumes for Halloween and you always got the best birthday cakes. My mom... She shakes her head. Your mom was busy. She had a lot of kids to take care of, I say. I wish... She stops herself. It's not that hard to figure out what she was going to say. She wishes her dad were here. Because her dad was the kind of dad all the kids wanted their dads to be. He was a fourth grade teacher, but one of the cool ones, one of those who wore dress shirts rolled up at the sleeves, who could play Bruce Springsteen and Coldplay on his guitar, who didn't look dumb in sunglasses. He had this big, booming voice that made you sit up and listen, but he was always in a good mood. Sadie flicks ashes off her cigarette. So, you think Ty wants you to make up with your dad? I remember the way I kept finding the empty frame on the floor in the hallway, the light on in the playhouse, the cologne. I could explain all those things away, but they seemed to add up to something. They seemed to add up to Ty. I don't know, I say. I wish there were some way I could figure it out definitively, one way or the other. I'm crazy, or I'm haunted. I don't care, I just want to know. I get that, Sadie says. I went to a medium once, did I tell you? I shift on the step and stare at her. No, you didn't tell me. When was this? Madam Penny. She takes a long drag, contorts her mouth to blow the smoke away from me. About 2 years ago. I reach over and take her cigarette out of her hand, chuck it in the snowbank. Hey, what the hell? I'm doing your lungs a favor. Anyway, Madam Penny... I push on before she has time to get truly mad at me. What was that like? I want details. She snorts. It cost me $100 for a half hour. I was so sure I was going to be able to talk to my dad. I had this gold watch that he used to wear all the time because her website said she worked better if you brought in an item that you associated with the person you wanted to speak with. I remember that watch. When Sadie's dad rolled up his sleeves to teach long division, we'd see it gleaming on his wrist. Sometimes during class, he'd pick one of the students to hold his watch and keep track of time when he read out loud to us, because he'd get lost in a story, he used to say. So what happened? I ask. I got in there, and she immediately said she could feel someone on the other side reaching out to me. An older male figure, she said. A wise man. Yeah? Your dad? Nope. She picks at a hole in the knee of her jeans. Gregory, she said his name was. He was a monk who died in the 12th century. I stare at her, completely baffled. What? Sadie laughs at my expression. Madam Penny said he was my spirit guide. He was there to direct me on my soul path. We each have an invisible helper in this life, she said, someone to lead us and help us along our way. If that's the case, then my spirit guide is fired, I say. I know, right? So, did you get to talk to your dad? I ask. but I can already see the answer coming. She looks off down the street for a few seconds before she answers. No. She went on about this Gregory person for 20 minutes, and then I tried to get her to look at the watch, and she started telling me about my grandfather, who died when I was 2, so I wouldn't have known him from Adam, and then she babbled on about a great lover I had in a past life, a guy in a bomber jacket who fought in the Second World War, who loved me like the moon and stars, I remember she said. He wanted to send me a message of love and forgiveness, she kept saying. Love and forgiveness. Forgiveness and love. And then my time was up.
It's quiet. Then Sadie finally says,
so it was a huge waste of money.
I try to keep it positive. Hey, but it was entertaining.
Right. It was a real barrel of laughs. I'm sorry. That sucks.
She shakes her head.
I was naive. God, $100. It kills me to think about all the stuff I could have bought with $100 back then.
It was an experiment, I said. You went in with an open mind.
I really thought my dad would talk to me, she says. I thought I would get all the answers.
She sniffles, and that's when I realize she's crying. It's been 2 years, and she's still so disappointed that she didn't get to speak to her dad that the thought brings her to tears. I envy her for that. I reach into my backpack to find a pack of tissues, which I carry around on the off chance that one of these days my tear ducts will start working again, and then I'll cry a fricking river. I hand her one.
But you still watch Long Island Medium, I point out as she takes it and dabs at her eyes. You're still a believer, right? Yeah, well, I prefer to think that Madame Penny was flawed.
Seriously, seriously flawed, I agree.
I was so pissed. I egged her house later,
Sadie confesses. My mouth falls open. Then we both start snickering. Then outright laughing.
You really are a delinquent, I observe when our laughter fades.
Wow! What did she look like? Was she all dark and mysterious and gypsy-like? Sadie thinks for a minute.
She looked like a cross between my grandma and Betty White. I remember she was wearing a sweater with Christmas trees sewn on the front.
She blows her nose, sighs.
Shit, I came here to cheer you up, not the other way around.
You did cheer me up, I say, which is true. She bumps her shoulder into mine.
You're a good friend, Lex.
No, I'm not, I think.
You're a good friend, too, I answer.
I'm glad you saw me running that night. I'm glad you took the time to figure out why.
Hey, I was serious when I said we should start running together again, she says. Just as soon as the weather warms up. You and me, jogging.
Don't push your luck, I say. She smiles, the traces of tears still silver on her cheeks. 28. It's funny how sometimes you don't see the obvious things coming. You think you know what life has in store for you. You think you're prepared. You think you can handle it. And then, boom, like a thunderclap, something comes at you out of nowhere and catches you off guard. Like on Wednesday, when Ashley Davenport ambushes me before first period. She's there on the other side of my locker door when I close it. I jump a mile.
Hi, she says.
She's dyed her hair again, a deep, glossy brown this time. It suits her. Makes her face all about her huge blue eyes, which are focused on me like laser beams, concerned, determined.
I've been hoping to catch you.
Okay.
I saw you at Patrick's wake,
she says, her voice hoarse like she has a cold. She doesn't offer me any other explanation. She simply takes off her backpack and puts it on the floor and pulls out a familiar, tattered envelope. For Ashley, it reads,
I think you should read this, she says.
Oh, is all I can think to say. I'm frozen. I don't really understand what's happening here. I thought that envelope was gone for good, that I'd never know what was in it. But here she is offering the letter, like what he had to tell her concerns me somehow. I swallow hard. The text. The text.
Do you want to go somewhere else, like the library?
she asks. But don't you have class? The bell rings. She shrugs and smiles faintly.
I can be late.
We go to the library. No one bothers us as we make our way to the lonely corner behind the stack where Ashley holds out the letter. My hands tremble as I take it.
I want it back, so I'll be over there.
She tilts her head to indicate the study tables in the center of the library.
Take as much time as you want.
Then it's just me and the letter. I slide it out of its envelope. The paper crackles as I unfold it. It's dated December 10th, 10 days before Ty died. I take a shaky breath and slide myself down against the corner, draw my knees up to my chest, and I read.
Dear Ashley, I wanted to write you this letter to explain why I broke it off with you. First, I have to say I'm sorry for how I did it. I didn't know what to say to you or how to explain the truth about how I feel, so I went with the old cliché, this isn't working for me, which made it sound like the problem was you. It's not you. You're the most amazing girl I've ever known. You are beautiful, strike that, but I think I should list smart first because you are so crazy smart and that's what I first noticed about you, that for such a gorgeous girl, you sure had your head on straight. You're a girl who knows things, and you had all these ideas and these complex thoughts about life. You're beautiful, too. You know that. People always tell you that. Sometimes when I would look at you, it used to make my chest hurt how beautiful you were. And you're funny. Remember that time you made me laugh so hard I snorted chocolate milk up my nose? But you didn't make a big deal over it, and that's because you're nice. You're nice to everybody. You're always considering how other people feel. I think that's what I admire most about you, how sweet you are in this world that's full of crap. Sorry. So it's really not about you, Ash. Please believe me when I say, strike that, write that. You are perfect. This is my problem. The other night when I kind of freaked out on you, sorry for that too, by the way, you were trying to get me to talk about my dad, and I said I hated my dad, and you got this surprised look like you didn't know I was the type of person who could hate someone, who could hate my dad. But I am. That's when I saw how messed up I am. And I saw myself so clearly right then, and it was like I could also see the future. You're so perfect, and you're so beautiful, and you're so kind, and when I'm with you, I want to be those things too. I want to be the best person, but the truth is, I can't. I'm messed up. I go through phases where I think everything's going to be okay, and the sky is blue and stuff, and I can feel the sun and the air going in and out of my lungs, and I think, life is good. But then every time, I also know deep down that the darkness is coming, and it's going to keep coming, and when I'm in the darkness, I'm going to screw up everything. And if you're with me, that's when I'm going to screw you up, too. You deserve better than that. You've got good friends and awesome parents and this amazing life ahead of you. You need to have a boyfriend who will be part of that. Not me. My sister has a boyfriend, and she's so into him, and she's freaked out that she's so into him because that's how she is, but when I see them together, I think, they work. Most couples in high school you know aren't going to work out, and maybe that's how it should be. But with them, it's so obvious that they're right for each other. They make each other better somehow. They fit. You and me, Ash, we don't fit. You're like the sun, and I'm like a big black cloud. I'd always be darkening your skies. I've tried, but I can't fix myself. I can't change it. So I did the right thing, letting you go. You'll see. It may take a little bit of time, but you'll understand. I wish I had the guts to tell you this out loud, or even give you this letter, but I probably won't. Still, I'm glad I wrote it. Putting it into words on paper helped me understand some things. I get it now. Don't cry any more tears over me, Ash. I'm not worth it. But I want you to know, in case I ever do give you this letter and you read it first before you burn it or something, that for just a little while, you made me feel like I was really alive. Like I was special. Thanks for that. Thanks for picking me to be the one who got to stand in your sunshine for a while. I'll carry that around with me for the rest of my life. That you saw enough good in me that you wanted to hold my hand and kiss me and smile at me like I was the only guy. Be happy. Love. Ty.
My chest feels like it's in a vice, tightening, tightening. I brush my fingers over the words in Ty's messy print, and over the stains on the paper where Ashley's tears must have dropped when she read it. I read the letter again, and again. I try to memorize every word. I sit there for a long time. The bell for second period rings. The library stirs as if, up till now, time has been stopped, but it's going again. I find Ashley at the back table. When she looks up at me, her face wrinkles up like she's going to cry, but she contains it. I hand her back the letter.
Thank you for letting me read this.
He was wrong, though. Her voice breaks. I'm not perfect. I have dark days, too. She wipes a tear off her pale cheek. I could have helped him if he would have let me, if he'd just given me the letter himself.
I'm sorry, I say.
She looks up with shining eyes.
No, thank you for giving it to me when you did.
I can't talk. I nod. She nods. Then we both have to move on.
20th of March. In the last photograph ever taken of Ty and Dad together, from back when we were still a family, they're playing chess. June 24th is the date my mom scrawled on the back of the photo, the summer I was 14 and Ty was 12, the year before Dad traded us for Megan. I remember that day. There was a tornado, an F4 on the Fujita scale, and if you speak the tornado lingo, which pretty much everybody in Nebraska does, you'll know that's not the most powerful tornado, the F5 is, but it's still big enough to take out a town like Raymond. When the sirens started going off, the twister had formed 20 miles north of us. The sky turned green. Mom herded us all into the basement to wait out the storm. We watched the news for a while on television, where a map of the area kept showing the tornado hovering above us, a swirling cartoon cyclone slowly moving in our direction. Then Dad suggested a game of chess. He'd been through his chess obsession a couple years before and hadn't played since, but there in the basement den was the beautiful mahogany board he'd purchased back then, and the marble pieces, and what else was there to do while we waited. I played first. I lost. Spectacularly, if I remember correctly. In spite of my math affinity, I'm not much good at chess. I'm short-sighted. I can't predict that far ahead, to the other player's choices and moves. I only see the pieces in front of me and react. I wasn't surprised when I lost. I'd never won against Dad. He's not the type to let his kids win just so they'll feel good about themselves. In his chess phase, I must have lost 100 games to him, and every time he'd take my king, he'd say, "Well played, Lexi. You're getting better. One of these days you're going to beat me." But I never did. So on June 24th, when I was 14 and stuck in the basement with my family and a chessboard, I played and I lost. I stuck out my tongue at Dad, and he chuckled at me, and then he said, "Tyler, you're up." Ty took his place on his side of the board with the look of an excited puppy. "Oh boy," I remember thinking, "this is going to be quick." But almost right away, he made a move that surprised Dad.
"Where'd you learn that?" Dad asked, squinting down at the board.
Ty shrugged.
"Is it a bad move?"
"No," Dad said distractedly.
"No, that was an excellent move. There's a name for it, even, if I can just remember it."
Before long, Ty made another excellent move, and another, and another. Before long, he was clearly winning the game. Then we had to stop for a bit when the sky went black. The lights flicked out. We all went into the bathroom with candles, where the pipes would provide some extra protection if the wind ripped the top of the house away. Ty and I got into the empty bathtub with the emergency radio. Dad sat on the counter with his arm around Mom.
"The Caro-Kann defense,"
he said after a minute.
That's it.
Yep, we were possibly about to die, and Dad was still marveling at Ty's chess moves. I looked at Ty. He had a secret smile. We didn't have to stay in the bathroom long. The tornado skimmed by Raymond and carried on to the east, where it took out a whole string of farms before it dissipated, and we could come out of the bathroom. Ty and Dad went right back to their game. Mom and I sat on either side of them, holding up candles to light the board, and watched it all go down, a rapt audience as Ty moved around the board like a pro. The whole time, Dad looked so confused. I mean, Ty was 12 years old. When Dad had gone through his chess phase before, Ty had been like 10. He hadn't even really grasped the rules of chess.
"How are you doing this?"
Dad asked finally when Ty took his queen.
"I've been playing a little on the computer,"
Ty confessed. He sat back.
"Checkmate."
Mom and I crowed. "Oh, how the mighty have fallen," Mom said. And I think she got a little too much satisfaction out of Ty winning, because she also had lost 100 games to Dad.
"I have to get a picture," she said.
So that's when the photo happened. In the picture, Ty has just won the game, and he's practically glowing, he's so happy. Dad is looking down, beaten, but he is smiling too. He was proud.
"Well done, son," he said.
He clapped his hand on Ty's shoulder and squeezed.
"Wanna go again?"
Ty shook his head.
"I better quit while I'm ahead."
The power came back on. We all blinked in the sudden brightness of the room. Ty grinned over at Dad.
"I have this new game on the Wii. Tennis. Do you want to try to beat me there? Loser buys McDonald's?"
"Sure,"
Dad said.
"You bet."
Sucker. It was a good day. A good memory. I don't want to be the kind of person who hates my dad. 29. That morning I watched the sunrise, and then I get in my car and drive. I know the way to Megan's house like I've driven there 100 times, straight down 27th Street to the south part of town, where the houses are old but expensive and well-maintained, wrought iron fences and such. Her house is a small, tan and green one near the zoo. It has a red door. Christmas lights are still strung along the edge of the roof. A black and white cat stares at me from the window. Dad's a dog person, by the way. I tuck Ty's collage frame under my arm and make my way carefully up the uneven sidewalk. I climb the steps onto the porch, take a deep breath, and ring the bell. It's warmer today, I realize. Water drips off the roof. The snow is melting. Megan answers the door. She is blonde and bobbed and dressed in a little navy blue suit dress. When she recognizes me, her face becomes the quintessential picture of surprise, her burgundy lipsticked mouth in a perfect O shape. Behind her, I see Dad, dressed for work, wearing a similar expression. "Hi," I say, moving past Megan and into the house. "Do you have a minute? We need to talk." 22nd of March. The lie I told Dad. The frame was behind the door. There's an empty space in the frame, a picture missing. By complete coincidence, I discovered this photo of Dad and Ty, not in a frame, on the floor behind the door. Therefore, it must have fallen out of its frame somehow. Therefore, Ty meant to put that photo of Dad in the collage. Therefore, Ty didn't leave Dad's picture out on purpose in order to hurt Dad. Therefore, it's possible that Ty forgives Dad. I don't know if he actually believed me, but it's a fiction I think we both can live with. 30.
"That," Dave says, "is what we in the business call a breakthrough. Good job."
It was no big deal. I fiddle with the edge of the rug. I was only there for 10 minutes.
"It's a very big deal, Lex."
Dave smiles.
"How long has your father been gone?"
3 years.
"And in all that time, you've never gone to his house?"
"Megan's house," I correct him. "No, I've never been there."
Why?
Because I don't know how to explain my reasons so that they seem rational. Perhaps they aren't rational.
Why yesterday, I mean?
Dave says.
Why go to Megan's house now?
I shrug. I finally had something I wanted to say to him.
And what was that?
I wanted him to know that his picture belonged in Ty's frame, that's all.
How did he react when you told him?
He cried. I'd never seen Dad cry before, not even at Ty's funeral, so it shocked me. He didn't make a big show of it. He put his hand to his eyes for a few minutes while his chest heaved and his shoulders shook, and then finally he dropped his hand. Then he said,
I'm so sorry, Lexi. I know what I did hurt you and your brother, and I am sorry for that.
I wanted to hold on to my anger when he said that. I could have answered that his sorry wasn't good enough. His sorry can't bring Ty back, which is true. But my anger was a slippery thing, like a fish I was trying to keep hold of, and it wiggled out of my grasp. I looked at Dad, and he looked at me with his hazel eyes, Ty's and my eyes, and he said,
I would have stayed. If it could have stopped Tyler from doing this, I would have come back.
I shook my head. It's too confusing, too hard to think about the what-ifs. I have my own personal list of what-ifs without having to deal with Dad's. He whispered again that he was sorry, and cried some more, so I laid my hand over his on Megan's kitchen table. He put his other hand over mine and squeezed, and we stayed that way for a few minutes, until I slid my hand away and told him I had to get going to school.
Thank you for coming,
he told me as he walked me down the driveway.
For telling me about the picture. It means a lot.
It didn't matter that almost everything I'd told him about the photo and the collage was a total fabrication on my part. You're welcome. I got into the car. Dad knocked on my window and leaned down to say,
Maybe you could come to dinner here next week. We could talk about MIT.
Maybe, I said, because MIT was still feeling pretty far away, and I didn't know, I still don't know, if I was ready to make Megan's house a regular thing. I have to go. I put the lemon in gear. Take care, Dad.
Take care, Lexi,
he said. I could see him in the rearview mirror, standing on the sidewalk in his suit and tie, his hand lifted in a wave as I drove away.
Alexis, are you still with me?
Dave prompts, because I'm just sitting there, not answering.
Are you all right? Would you like some water?
I cough. Sure. He opens the mini-fridge under his desk and gets me a Dasani. I drink. He said he was sorry, I say when I'm ready to talk again. For the divorce. For the way it hurt Ty and me. Dave nods. Aren't you going to write that down? I ask him. It seems important. A breakthrough, like you said. He doesn't write it down.
Do you accept his apology?
He asks. Sort of. Maybe. Probably not.
Do you feel like you've started to forgive him?
I don't know, I say. I don't think he should get off that easy. But it was nice to hear him say he's sorry. I didn't think I'd ever hear him say that. Dave strokes his beard, which is what he does when he's about to say something terribly profound.
Forgiveness is tricky, Alexis, because in the end it's more about you than it is about the person who's being forgiven.
Like that old saying about how holding a grudge is like drinking poison and then waiting for the other person to die.
Exactly.
Dave sits back, puts his feet up on the coffee table.
I'm proud of you. To go to that house, to face him, to give him that small kindness with the picture, that took courage. It was a step in the right direction.
The direction to what, though? I ask. Where am I headed?
Acceptance, which is the path to healing, growth, contentment.
I mull this over. I will never be happy again, Mom said. She said it like it's her duty now, her motherly obligation to consider her life ruined because she lost Ty. I don't view things the way Mom does, but it's difficult to imagine being truly happy again. I don't know what my duty is.
How did you feel when you were done talking to your father?
Dave asks. I felt slightly better, I tell Dave. This he feels compelled to write down in his yellow legal pad. He underlines the words.
Slightly better is good, he says.
I agree. Slightly better is good. But I don't know what I'm supposed to do now.
Lex, Dave says. Are you okay?
Sometimes I think I see Ty. I don't know where this comes from, this sudden confession, but suddenly it's out there. I glance at Dave quickly. Sometimes I feel like he's there, in the house, and I feel like he wants something from me. I brace myself to be sent off to the funny farm. Dave nods.
That's very common, actually.
I stare at him. Common?
It's common for people to continue to see loved ones who have passed. When he was alive, your brother took up a certain space in your life, a physical space and an emotional one. Now that he's gone, the brain naturally tries to fill in that empty space.
So it doesn't mean I'm going crazy, I venture. Dave lets out a bark of laughter.
No, Lex, you're certainly not crazy.
And it doesn't mean that Ty is a ghost, either. For some reason, this revelation brings on the ache in my chest. It turns out there's a logical explanation after all. So why don't I want to believe it? 31. Sadie's running outfit is hot pink. It's impossible to miss her at the end of my driveway, hopping from foot to foot, warming up. She says the pink makes her feel like an atom bomb. Like a nuclear explosion is her exact phrasing, pronouncing it nuke-ular, the way George W. Bush used to say it, even though he knew it was wrong just to piss people off. How Sadie and I are friends, I still don't know. Come on, she hollers at me. Let's get moving already. We run. Spring seems to have finally arrived, so we've been running. Today is our second attempt this week in the couch to 5K plan. I'm wearing yoga pants and a mathlete t-shirt, and I do not feel anything like a nuclear explosion. I hate running as much as ever. It's a horrible thing to do to yourself. Waterboarding, really, would be kinder. There's an upside, though. I do like the quiet of the early morning jogs around our neighborhood, the only sound our footfalls on the asphalt and our labored breathing in the spring air. I like the stillness in the air just before the sun rises. I like the colors that gather in the sky, the way everything, for just those few moments, seems fresh and unsullied. Sadie's watch beeps. Okay, walk, she says. We slow to a brisk walk. This is the early part of the jog, before I feel like I'm going to die, so I am able to answer Sadie when she asks me if I've seen the ghost. I haven't seen him, not since I told the big whopper to my dad about the collage. How about you? For some reason, I can't bring myself to tell her about what Dave said, that seeing Ty is a common occurrence, my brain filling in the spaces my brother used to occupy. Me? She looks over at me quizzically. How's Gregory, the spirit guide? I grin. She grins back. Oh, right. Gregory is fabulous. He's got my life all planned out. Her watch beeps. Run, she orders, and off we go. Actually, she says when we're at the next walking interval, I'm thinking about going to college. Not the Massachusetts Institute of Technology or anything, she says with proper dramatic flair. But I've looked into a few community colleges, and then if I liked that, I could transfer to UNL. Good for you! I beam at her, as much as I am capable of beaming in this jogging situation. I told you, you're smart. You should do something with that. I'm thinking psychology or counseling. Get paid the big bucks for people to tell me all of their problems. We pass by one of our neighbors, old Mrs. Wilson, who is watering her flowers. She looks at us suspiciously. Sadie waves. Mrs. Wilson scowls and goes back in the house. What about MIT? Sadie asks me. What's going on with that? Not much. I'm supposed to be getting a call from one of the students this week. and next month I'm going to visit the campus.
You don't sound very excited.
I am, though.
You're scared, Sadie teases.
No, I'm just anticipating this huge change, and I've never been great with change.
I've been thinking about MIT a lot, just 6 months away. I know better than anyone how much can change in 6 months. Sadie's watch beeps. Run, she yells, and we run, and I stop thinking for a while and focus on survival. Walk, run, walk, run. I'm out of breath. I have a stitch in my side. I'm pretty sure I hate Sadie. For each step of the routine, the run parts seems longer and the walk parts seem shorter. After 6 of these, I feel like I'm going to die. Walk, she says, finally. Last leg. Thank God. If I believed in God. How's your mom? Sadie asks between pants as we cool down. I saw her at the grocery store yesterday, and she looked... slightly better, I fill in. Yeah, she looked better. She's doing okay. She laid off the wine and the pills, and she's going to church again, which seems to give her some energy, so, yes, she's doing better. Mom and I haven't talked about my little speech in the car on the way home from Graceland, but I feel like she heard me. That's something. It's such a cliche, the whole time heals all wounds thing, but it's true. Cliches are cliches for a reason, I guess, Sadie says as we drag ourselves into her front yard. Hey, do you want to ride to school later? I check my watch. You mean in like 15 minutes later? Sure. It would rock to not ride the bus. Okay, so shower, do something with that hair, I'm just saying, or whatever you need to do, and meet me back here in 15 minutes. 14 minutes later, I'm back at the McIntyre house. Sadie comes out, hair still wet, but eyeliner perfectly in place, and unlocks the doors to her old Jeep Grand Cherokee with its peeling red paint. I'm still thinking about MIT.
Are you okay? She asks me.
Fine. I'm just jealous that you have a car that actually works. I glance at the dashboard. You're almost out of gas, by the way. She shrugs.
Gas is expensive.
The light is on. Do you even have enough for us to make it to school? She rolls her eyes, annoyed that I have to be so darned practical, and turns the car off. Then she unbuckles her seatbelt. Wait here. She leaves the door open and the keys in the ignition alarm ringing, goes into the garage, and reappears a few minutes later lugging a big red gasoline can.
Seth always keeps extra for his motorcycle.
She reaches under the seat to pop the gas door. As if on cue, Seth and said motorcycle pull into the driveway. He sputters to a stop next to the Jeep and removes his helmet. His spiky hair is smashed, and he runs his hand over it as he watches Sadie struggle to pour the gas into the tank.
May I ask what the hell you're doing? He asks.
I'll fill it up for you after school.
You be sure to do that.
He looks like he wants to say more, but he's noticed me sitting there. He smiles. I roll down my window as he walks around to my side of the car.
Hey, Lex, he says. Still hanging out with this loser?
This is the most awake I've ever seen him look. Yes. I try, but can't think of a clever quip. Did you just get off work?
Yep. Time for the party to begin.
He smiles again. Sadie scoffs and says something I don't catch, but is undoubtedly an insult, which seems doubly rude since she is stealing his gasoline. He leans against the window.
So, he says casually, seen any ghosts lately?
I stare at him, frozen, until I remember the ghost story he told us. Yeah, I try to counter. I saw one just last month, as a matter of fact.
Cool,
he says. Sadie slams the gas compartment shut and sets the empty gas can on the floor behind her seat.
All right, Sethy, we have to go now, she says in a sing-song voice. We don't want to be late for school.
Seth ignores her.
I could still give you that ride.
I stare at him.
What, now?
How about it, Lex? You, me, Georgia, the wind in your hair.
Sadie jumps in and starts the Jeep. Not today, Seth. She's covered, ride-wise. Sadie says, bye, have a nice sleep. Seth looks at me like he's still waiting for an answer. I cough. Not today, I say as the car starts to move. Thanks.
Someday, though, he says.
Sure.
I'm going to hold you to that,
he calls after us as Sadie and I back out of the driveway. I'm sure he will. We blast down the road toward school. Sadie is a definite leadfoot. Hey, about Seth, I venture.
Yeah?
Was he flirting with me? I'm terrible at interpreting these things, but he keeps trying to get me to ride his motorcycle. Sadie snorts.
Don't take this the wrong way, Lex, but no. Seth doesn't know how to talk to women without flirting, but when he really likes a girl, he gets all tongue-tied.
I don't know whether to be insulted or relieved. Good to know. She frowns and taps at the gas gauge, which is still moving toward empty. You know, if you're planning on going to college, I can't help but inform her, it might be wise to start riding the bus more regularly. There are, I do a quick calculation in my head, 63 days of school left. That's $193.41. That could buy your books next semester. She looks at me like I've lost my mind. I take eighth period off, which is starting to become a bad habit of mine. Instead, I sit in the gym and watch the cheerleaders practice. So I'm present for that one moment that Ashley Davenport looks up and sees me, and waves, and I wave back, and my wave says, thank you. I shouldn't be surprised when Damien comes to find me.
Hey, he says, appearing at the top of the bleachers. I have some pictures for you.
I flip through them. They're mostly in black and white, stills of Ty about to make a shot on the basketball court, one where he is lifting a water bottle to his lips, sweat gleaming off his brow, one where he is smiling at a very particular cheerleader. And then, at the bottom of the pile, a picture of Damien. A selfie, shot at a strange, lopsided angle so I can see his torso and his face, but the top of his head is chopped off. In the picture, he's wearing the shark tooth necklace. My chest gets tight. This is nice, I murmur. You're talented. He clears his throat.
Thanks.
I read The Metamorphosis, I report. You were right, it's an amazing book. Talk about absurdity, right?
You read it already?
I did. I stayed up all night with it a couple nights ago. No Cliff's Notes this time. It was actually pretty cool. Damien shoves his hands in his pockets and beams at me.
I love that we never get an explanation of why one day he wakes up as a bug. He simply is.
It's brilliant how he shows us the way our bodies can become disconnected from our minds, I add. Gregor is a bug, but he always manages to keep a part of his humanity. Even when being a bug makes everyone hate him, he's still human, inside.
But he's alone,
Damien says softly.
He's always going to be a bug on the outside, until they decide to get rid of him.
I clear my throat. Anyway, I was thinking we should meet up sometime and talk about this stuff. Books, I mean. You seem to know so much about literature, and I'm going to MIT next year, and I am really intimidated by the English requirement. I feel like every time I open my mouth, I'm going to end up saying something completely stupid.
You won't, he says. You're so smart, Lex. Come on.
I'm not smart about books, I argue. Not like you. So, can you help me? He brushes his long hair out of his eyes, but it falls right back in his face. Then he straightens up his hunched shoulders and says slowly,
"We could meet at Barnes & Noble. I could show you some more books you might like."
"That sounds perfect," I say. "How about tomorrow night?" He looks startled.
"Saturday night?"
"Yeah, after dinner maybe. 7?" He gives a little laugh.
"Okay, the South Point Barnes & Noble. That's the one I always go to."
I'd prefer to avoid that particular B&N for reasons I don't want to explain to him, but it is what it is. Okay, do you need a ride? My car is always a bit of a gamble, but I think I could get us there. He shakes his head quickly.
I can drive myself.
I live in the boonies, and I wouldn't want to make you go all the way out there. I'll meet you at 7 at the bookstore.
Tomorrow. 7. We'll talk bugs, I say.
And books.
And books.
Right now,